Hi, and welcome to this VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour, joined by Matt Wallen. How are you, Matt?
I'm great.
I was just confused then as to which intro I was doing, because for the first time in a long time, I've just done an RC podcast discussing the Red Nikon acquisition thing. So my mind was an RC, not VFX
show. It's cool. Is that with Mr. Wingrove?
It is, yeah. We put the band back together to discuss that acquisition, but also just because it's the two of us and we have complete lack of discipline, we discussed everything else under the sun.
It's excellent.
Computational photography, what he's shooting with now, lenses, just a bunch of stuff. It was good. But yeah.
Very
That's
cool.
Over on FX Guide if you're listening. And I guess it would be in an RC podcast feed, but as that RC podcast feed hasn't been active for quite a while, you'd probably want to go to the website to click on it and download the link. But we're not here to discuss that. We're here to discuss the, I think, rather brilliant Masters of the Air. And unfortunately, Jason can't be with us. The other Jason Diamond, he's at South by Southwest, but that's all right. We didn't want to talk to him anyway. We don't really like him. No, I'm just kidding. I hope he's having a good time at South by Southwest.
Yeah, I'm sure he's having a blast.
So I adored this series, Masters of the Air. What about you?
Yeah, I mean, I can't tell a lie. I really absolutely loved the first Band of Brothers series that was probably over a decade or maybe more old. And I really loved the Pacific as well. Also equally great, different, but equally good, I think. And I love the Apple TV film. I think we did a show on, what was that one called? The Navy one with Tom Hanks.
Greyhound?
Greyhound. I thought that was really wonderfully made. And a similar oeuvre, right? It's kind of the same team. And when I saw that they were making this, I had a little bit of a twinge at the title. But the second I saw some of the first footage from it, it is in keeping with the tradition of those excellent series from the past. And I think it's... I equally have just loved it. I've really enjoyed it. And I think it has some truly incredible visual effects in it.
Yeah, it's really interesting. I wasn't as big a fan of the Pacific as Band of Brothers because I felt like it didn't have the same narrative thread. And there are a couple of things of Band of Brothers that just made it spectacularly good. In addition to the craft kind of making it. I think it was the fact that at the end of the show, you got to see the actual guys that were in the story. So, and you'd been seeing them all the way through, but it never really been explained. And so then it was like, oh my God, I do love that. And they did it in Masters of the Air as well. Like they just, you get to see these are the guys. So I think
there was some richer character development in that first Band of Brothers series too, with the I can't remember that one actor's name, the redheaded British guy who was so great as the sort of lead. And then the young sort of alcoholic guy, Nixon from Office Space, I think was the second character in that. And then so many other really richly developed characters that you come to know through the course of it. And this series has been following in that tradition too.
Yeah. Lewis, who plays
Damian Winters. Lewis.
Is so good. And also the other thing is I felt like, and look, this is a bit sort of whatever, but I you kind of want to, for me anyway, in these sorts of dramas, root for somebody. And I felt in the Pacific, I didn't really have the same sense of rooting for characters. It was graphic and horrendous as war is. It was informative and well-made as Band of Brothers was, but like you just were rooting for Winters and so many of the other people in the original series to just see if they'd make it through the war, right? And because you didn't know whose vignettes you were seeing during the, you know, episodes, you didn't know who those people were. You couldn't know who was going to survive. Whereas obviously if you're watching some like Oppenheimer type drama, which is from the Second World War, obviously, but you know that what happened to Oppenheimer because he's a historical figure that, you know,
right.
If there's a film about Winston Churchill that he's going to make it through the war and he's going to win the war. Here, you knew that they were going to succeed at the war, but you didn't know the price that was going to pay on the individuals on Band of Brothers. And so I just found that to be super moving. And the same thing that I just described, I think applies equally to this one, which is you don't know how it's going to finish. You don't know who's going to survive the war and how they're going to be affected.
Yeah, I was going to say real quick too, like on the just the idea of this generation of filmmakers. You know, you got Spielberg making Saving Private Ryan.
Many things.
Yeah. And also Schindler's List.
Yeah.
But then you've got Tom Hanks, you know, with Playtown getting into working with Amblin to produce the first Band of Brothers, and then to follow in that line of all these kind of series of episodics, as well as the other standalone movie, The Greyhound, we were talking about. I think what's really exciting is you've got a generation of filmmakers who are post-World War II, you know, baby boomers and even some younger folks who are involved in the making of these things, certainly in terms of the actors and many of the crew members and effects teams and stuff. But it's so exciting that there's this real endeavor on the part of the sort of forces behind the making of these to keep that story alive, to keep the story alive of the horrors really of World War II, and to keep those narratives in play in a world that seems to be forgetting so much of that, to keep that in the public eye and to keep that kind of conversation going, I think is extremely valuable.
Yeah. Spielberg actually said that they want to catalog all of these aspects while there are still good references to all of them. I guess the other thing that I'd say at a personal level, there's two things I'd like to say. I'd like to say, one, I think that it was clever to not totally make the Germans out to be villains. They were the enemy of the peace. Clearly, they were the forces that were to be defeated. But they didn't sort of make out the Germans to be caricatures of evil Nazi. Because even in the original, and it actually particularly in Band of Brothers, at the end, if you remember the head of, I can't remember which section of the German, either Army or Air Force, it must have been Army, hands over his weapon to Winters. And it's a very, it's acknowledging that while absolutely there were diabolical atrocities done by the hardcore Nazis, there also were people in the German army that were not the hardcore Nazis, but kind of patriots to their cause, in the same way that I would say about Japan, right? Like I've just come from Japan, where I got to go to Hiroshima for the first time, or Hiroshima, and I felt that the Peace Museum there was equally respectful of the fact that the atrocity of the deaths of the people from the atomic bomb is undeniable. But by the same token, it serves no one to paint every part of your enemy as being just diabolically caricaturally, you know, a caricature of evil kind of unthinking morons. And so it's a delicate balance to get.
Anybody and everybody caught up in a struggle like that, like, you know, there is always that sort of jingoistic, nationalistic kind of perspective. But I think, at least from all the things I've read about war, I've never fought in a war and hopefully never will, but you know, anybody who's been in that environment, in that universe, doesn't wish it on anyone, regardless of whatever it is that they may have thought going in. You know, sort of the ignorance of youth and the idea of, you know, adventure or whatever, but then the reality of it being something altogether so much more horrific.
I think the other thing that is the case for me personally, which is the second point I wanted to make, is my father fought in the Second World War. Now, he was Navy, but he wrote a book about his experiences, and the dedication inside it was from a generation that fought a war so our children wouldn't have to.
Yep.
And I find the sentiment of this generation to be not, you know, not a blanket thing, and I know this is like a broad brushstroke, but there was a sense of duty and honor and doing the right thing that I just don't feel like there's enough of in the world today. And so I gravitate towards these stories where people are being selfless, in the sense that in this particular instance, right, we're looking at a lot of people that are fighting a war that isn't directly necessarily impacting their personal families. I mean, it's a different, look, I, you know, the Oscars were last night, and the Oscar for documentary over what was happening in the current war. Yeah, that's a story, right? Where you have a town or a city that's being directly impacted by, in this case, the Russian invasion. And obviously, there's 100% overlap with the horrors of that war and any war. But by the same token, there is something to be said for looking at people that decided to volunteer to go fight overseas because they thought it was the right thing to do. And I don't know, I just find that just such an admirable thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's what they call, at least over here, it's coined, I think, by a popular reporter who wrote a book and talked about the greatest generation, right? Being that generation that lived through the Depression and then fought in the Second World War, to defeat fascism is sort of how they paint the picture here. But yeah, I think you're right. I think that sense of duty and sacrifice and of a collective shared vision of almost a shared vision of a kind of cultural sense of right and wrong and like of wanting to sort of support and help those less fortunate. I do think that that is something that in our current, you know, global society it's harder to come by, I think, because the ideas of political machinations and of agency have become so diffuse and mediated through so many different other kinds of systems and devices and means of communication that it's hard to maintain a singular narrative that the bulk of the population can glom onto. One of the things that I saw just before the Oscars, I don't know if you've seen it yet, was the new Jonathan Glazer Zone of Interest, which is a powerful movie. We just watched it the night before we watched the Oscars, and all about a family of the commandant of Auschwitz living right next door over the wall from the concentration camp and sort of the banality of and normalcy of their everyday life while hearing the constant drone of the furnaces and of like people screaming, soldiers shouting, occasionally shots being fired. And they go on living their life as if nothing's happened. And that detachment, I mean, there's so many fascinating stories connected to, you know, the horrors of the Second World War. And I think this is one of those narratives. And fortunately for all of us, I think as visual effects artists and as, you know, fans of cinema and great storytelling, it's really on par with all of those greatest narratives. And it really touches all those points really well.
I haven't seen it, and I look forward to seeing it. Of course, I touched on that a bit in the film that I worked on, The Champion, because they had
right.
the same thing in The Champion. At one stage, she goes into the house of the commandant, and it's just this ridiculously normal house. Yeah, so I get exactly what you're saying. Here's the thing, and one of the reasons that I think it's good for us to start our podcast about this is that this weight of both responsibility, importance of material, and respect for the material is 100% what the filmmakers took into making Masters of the Air. And I know that because we did an interview with Steven Rosenbaum, who is the visual effects supervisor of the show, the whole series. Yep. And I did that because I've known Steven for ages. And I did that, it was actually the 1000th podcast I did. But I did it, I got permission to see all the eps like way back. And so when I saw that, I did that interview. So that interview is on FX Guide, but it doesn't discuss what we're going to be discussing today because that would have been spoilers for all of the eps that were coming. But he, in that podcast interview, discusses that they were completely aware of that. And what that translates to is not just an authenticity of the tone and narrative that we've been discussing, but of course, wanting to get the visual effects right, wanting to get an accurate portrayal of what it would have been like. And to go to the kind of detail that maybe the audience doesn't necessarily have to pick up on the first or second viewing. One of the examples he gave, which I thought was really delightful, is clearly Tom Hanks is one of the driving forces of this new series, as he was for the other ones. And he in particular, they built an entire plane and they have it on the tarmac. It wasn't a plane to fly, it was a plane to be in and taxi and do that stuff. And he, Tom, insisted on having a lot of screen time devoted to the switches and what was going on in the cockpit and what they actually had to do stuff. And I think Stephen joked in the podcast that if it, you know, Tom had had his way, they'd have spent half an episode just on the switches in the cockpit, right? Because it was just really important that you get a faithful understanding of what they had to work with. And by the same token, for me anyway, it was a real eye-opener to see how much destruction there was on those planes when they landed. Because by modern instances, I kind of think, well, I don't want anything to fall off a plane, like in the slightest. I don't want like a nut to fall off a plane. Here, they were landing with huge gaping holes in the fuselage, obviously men both dead and injured, but just from a flying point of view, I can't imagine how some of these planes stayed in the air. And it was not a comfortable exercise. There were people that were being frozen to death effectively by the high altitudes that they had to go in. And it was just like just the range of stuff they had to do. And so that sense of, well, let's get all those facts right because we kind of owe it to the people that were actually flying these planes.
Totally.
Means there's just such an extra layer on the visual effects and the production design team. And I think it's really to their credit how well they did that.
Yeah, I mean, I think I had a chance when I was in Palm Springs to fly, like it was part of the Mars conference in the PT-17, which is a twin prop plane, but it's from that same era, another World War II plane. And it's cool. It was so cool, but I can't lie. It was the scariest plane ride I've ever been on in my life. I mean, it really is like stepping into this like really crazy tin can. And you can't believe that thing, that when you watch the film, the accuracy or what I perceive to be the accuracy, I mean, I've never been in a B-17, but the level of detail and the peril that you feel through all of the production design, the set design and visual effects, the peril that you feel in those scenarios where you're in these cramped small spaces with all the pilots and gunners and tail gunners and co-pilots, navigators, the claustrophobia, the unpressurized environment of the plane flying at these high altitudes, you know, in extremely frigid conditions. You know, they're wearing these big, heavy leather jackets with all this kind of sheepskin kind of stuff on the inside, and then the fact that they're up there and they're plotting this journey. And then at the same time, they're, you know, trying to hit their target, but then they're under attack, you know, through all the ground fire, the flak exploding around them, but then all the German fighters coming in and really just eviscerating some of these, the fuselage of some of these airplanes and cockpits and some of the effects I'm sure we'll start to talk about too, but the gore of it is really just absolutely horrifying and so inhuman, the environment that they're in. It's really, it feels almost like watching some of the combat sequences, which I think are excellently done. I heard that interview with Stephen Rosenbaum and it's fantastic. I mean, I knew Stephen from my time at ILM and I mean, what a, like a, just a gem of a guy. I mean, he's such a
absolutely
kind and incredibly intelligent. I mean, that was always the thing I thought about. He's just so freaking smart working with him at ILM. And
well, let's just take a moment to note his previous credits, right? Avatar, like Contact, Forrest Gump. Like, I mean, the guy is a multiple Oscar winner. He's
for sure.
He's just talented.
Yeah, super great guy.
But I interrupted you. Go on.
Oh no, I was just gonna say, like, I think, you know, the totality of the construction of all the elements that go into this, the at least the sense of accuracy, I just can only assume. I'm a little ignorant of some of the technical accuracy, but I can only assume that they've done all that work. And I think that was part of what Stephen was talking about with you too. And I just think it's so fantastic. It almost feels like it's so alien, it's so foreign to the world that we inhabit today that you almost feel like you're watching something that's like a science fiction movie taking place on another world that feels like Earth with humans. It's so almost unbelievable that this was, you know, what it was like for people in those situations. And I know they've made other films about bombers. The most famous one, I think, was that film, I believe it was made in the 80s, the Memphis Belle movie that was about the other, I think another B-17 that had completed you know, it's whatever, 20 missions or whatever it was. And they had never been shot down or had always come back from their missions. And it had, I think, Matthew Modine in it. And
yeah,
I haven't seen that movie, I think, since it was in the theaters. But, you know, this has long been a narrative sphere that I think is really an exciting one for filmmakers. There's elements of it that feel like, you know, space battles from Star Wars, where you're in the gunner part of the Millennium Falcon or something. And
well,
I think that, just
that's no
visually,
accident, right?
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. Well, right. Exactly. That's what they're borrowing from, for sure.
Yeah.
In the Star Wars films, but it makes for such exciting cinema, and with visual effects that are so high in their level of achievement. You know, these gorgeous hard surface models with beautiful textures, these incredible skyscapes, and these elaborate vistas with, you know, sometimes in some shots, there's like hundreds of aircraft in a single shot. And they pause at times within the work. There's one, I think it's in episode 2 or episode 4. I can't remember which. I think it might've been 4. And it just blew me away, where they're flying and we're in the cockpit and it's just total chaos. And suddenly everything goes into slow motion. And it's just the most spectacular. It looks like they're kind of goofy when you see them, but they're fun to look at. These World War II paintings that you might see in like a, you know, an air history museum or something, yeah, where there are these big broad murals. And it looks like that, but it looks photo real. And it's just incredible. Like there's so much to look at. It's the kind of thing where there's really rich, complex visual effects work where there's no way you can see everything in the shot in a single viewing. Like you can't. There's too much
going
on.
The shot for me for that is the shot looking down at the D-Day landings. There's this really brief, because they don't, the narrative of the story doesn't focus heavily on D-Day. I thought it would. I thought it would like actually culminate in D-Day. That was what I was kind of thinking at the time. But the story takes a different path. But by that stage, they had air superiority over the channel. But there are shots looking down at the D-Day landing where I'm like, I need to see that many times more before I can even take in what I'm seeing. And a couple of things I'll say about that. The speed, and we mentioned this in the podcast with Stephen, the speed that the planes are going at is somewhere, depending on whether they're cruising, like 170 miles an hour or up to like 200, I think I wrote down 263. And apparently the fastest they ever went was like 313 miles an hour. So that's how fast they're going in the flying fortresses. And then there's a fighter, Messerschmitt, coming at you the other way.
Yeah.
So the relative speed that you're crossing at is like, you know, now you think about Formula One cars and how hard it is to film those and see kind of what's going on. And as they're whipping past, the cameraman just does a, you know, snap pan around to try and follow the action. Now imagine that the cameraman's traveling at 300 miles an hour as the Formula One cars came past. You'd never see anything, right? And how you were meant to hit anything while pointing a gun out the window at that, and how you were not meant to hit every other plane in your...
That's what I kept thinking. It's like, when they're shooting from the side gunner or the tail gunner or even the front gunner, like they're tracking and shooting, trying to get ahead of the German fighters that are, you know, flying and, you know, like Hornets around them. Like they're trying to track and hit those. And how you could do that and not turn in following them and shoot one of your own planes. That wasn't something that was ever suggested in the show. And even the idea of, like, I know in, you know, World War One, well, and the World War II planes, where the guns are shooting through the propeller, right? It's timed so that it goes through the prop. But you look at some of these, like the turret guns, and you think like, well, you could really rotate around and you could shoot your own aircraft even, you know?
Yeah, certainly shoot. Feel like you could shoot your own tail, definitely.
Yeah, totally.
And then, so that was extraordinary. And I think one of the things that I found just really interesting about it is we know from other great films like Scorsese's that you need clouds in the air to kind of orientate.
Yep.
And without the clouds, it's actually really hard to tell how fast anyone's moving. And even if you could, so they kept the point of view from the pilots that were on the Allies side. Mm-hmm, they didn't jump to the Germans. They didn't do crazy virtual cameras that just went everywhere. They did a few wide shots that were clearly from some vantage point, but not not weird and wonderful CG flying. So you had to orientate yourself, understand what was going on, incredibly high speeds, and they couldn't just do lots of, here, let me just diagrammatically kind of show you a good angle that you can work out what's going on. I just found it, like that choreography and staging was great.
And the use of the condensation and the vapor trails that are left by the aircraft at high altitude, I think that also really helped orient you to both place, space, and the speed and motion of, you know, whether it's, you know, seeing all the vapor trails of a massive German, you know, fighter group coming, you know, from, you know, 12 o'clock high or whatever it is, you know, seeing some of that, I think it really helped orient you, the viewer, and really gives you a sense when you see the number of contrails, it gives you a sense of what they're up against too. You start to get a sense of almost like a, in the way that, you know, when we were talking about Napoleon, right? When you look at some of those huge battles, the kind of classical kind of, you know, marching in, you know, kind of a line kind of battle, you can see like all these different people, but here we're seeing kind of a similar thing, much more chaotic, not so orderly, but you get that same sense of scope, scale, and numbers of aircraft involved. Even if you can't see them, you can see those contrails and maybe a, you know, a small silhouette of an aircraft at a distance. And I thought that was great. And when they do whip by, when they, like you're saying, when the plane is going at X, the bomber's going at X speed, where you sort of feel like, well, we're in the bomber, so we're static, that's our speed. And then we're seeing the fighter go by. They do a great job of, I thought, portraying the insanity of that that differential, that speed shift. But also you do get just a glimpse of it. And the audio cues, I think the sound design really helps sell it. Like you get a sense through that sound design that, you know, oh, wow, that's like so close. You know, you hear it, it's moving through, you know, stereo and giving you a really great sense of like the dynamics of the environment out there.
Yeah. And as spectacular, and they are spectacular shots that Stephen and his team came up with, it didn't feel like it was sort of losing sight of the fact that people were dying. Do you know what I mean? It wasn't like, oh, wow, it's just a sport. And I lost sort of a touch with the fact that on both sides of these, people are dying. Like there was a constant reminder of the price that was being paid of your own crew and of, you know, mates and friends in other planes as they went down. And just I mean, I love the acting when they were looking for the chutes and where the chutes were coming out of the planes and the fatalism and yet sort of dedication to keep going. There's so many aspects about way that was structured so that they still allowed the actors to act into those scenes. Now, from a technical point of view, they actually had, you know, a ton of work on a gimbal so that they could have the guys in planes doing stuff, and ridiculously so. Like they were joking that they were getting jet lagged because they were in the plane so long. And it, not a very comfortable plane at that, right? Even if it's on the ground, it's still not very comfortable. By the way, just before I forget, when you were talking earlier, I wanted to just do a shout out. If you are interested in the bombing aspects of the history of this, a complete look at the bombing stuff is done by a book that Malcolm Gladwell did called The Bomber Mafia. And it actually covers not only the bombing that we're talking about, but then what happened in Japan. And it'll, if you like me and you were a bit ignorant as to the non-nuclear nature of the bombing on Japan, this is a, horrendous is the right word, incredibly informative look at the firebombing that took place and was caused by the bombing and the politics of the logic of what went on behind it. We're not here to discuss that now, but I really enjoyed that book. And in this film, they do discuss the value of the scopes and how the Americans were doing daylight bombing and stuff. And they don't spend a lot of time on that. I almost wish that they did more, but then it becomes a documentary and, you know, that's not what they were there for. But
yeah, and that they have to scuttle and destroy any of those. They can't have them be captured because the technology, you know, which is so funny because it's this huge, I mean, it looks like a giant, like, optical typewriter or something, you know, it's this behemoth of a machine. But that technology was so advanced at the time and really a secret to the ability to be at least more accurate with, you know, kind of dumb bombs. But yeah, that's a really interesting component of the narrative.
So the thing that we used to joke about on the show, the thing that was the giveaway of a bad visual effects production is somebody driving in a car and we never got out the window looking accurate.
Right.
And it was always like the focus was wrong, or like it'd be the window itself would be out of focus, but what was on the other side of the window was in focus. And it's like, you know, focus doesn't work that way. And I've got to say, one thing that never could I fault was the sense of what they were placing outside the planes, given that there was so much of it. Because as you were discussing, you've got the gunners with the big doors open, you've got the pilots looking out through the windows, and you've got them looking down from their, like kind of over their shoulder as they're watching maybe whether shoots are coming out of a plane that's going down. And it was just perfectly comped, in my opinion, for that issue of focus, defocus, what should be pulling focus.
A lot of it was they were using light stage too, right? Like, so they had stages that they were using where they had some previs and other imagery that, so they were capturing a lot of the lighting. That's, a lot of it wasn't final pixels, but they were able to get a lot of that kind of interactivity and a sense of placement and where, you know, where actors needed to be looking too. But I just think that the biggest difference to my eye anyway, and again, I haven't shot on a light stage. I've never actually been on a light stage. But I think what's interesting about it is the composite component. To my estimation, when I watch those, it can't be anything but gassed, like so hard, like in a positive way, like pushed so much further by that kind of interactive lighting. Like it gets that composite so much closer to being something that looks good. Because one of the killers in so many comps that are done in that kind of old school way that we mock is that the lighting just, there's no, it doesn't match. So
there's
whatever's
no,
outside
no contact
the window.
Lighting.
Yeah, it just, that's why it looks so, one of the reasons why it can look so goofy is because, they are separate. And we just, the visual acuity of the human eye and the way we're used to just seeing the world, like when it doesn't look like what we see, we know it right away. And I think that having that interactive lighting and getting all that kind of, you know, the edging on the people and getting that, extracting that, and then putting that comp back out there, you're so much closer than you would be otherwise.
I'd say there are three things on that comp, right? On that type of comp. For one, I think you're absolutely right. Contact lighting is just
focus
focus is another one. I think that really, like, it betrays it when you want to see what's outside the window, but you couldn't actually hold it in camera. And so they just compromise and let you see what's outside the window. And it's like, no, that just doesn't work. You mentioned the eyeline stuff. So I'll put that in contact lighting. That's like this interactivity that happens with the actors that is just super marvelous. And from Gravity to, certain Christopher Nolan space dramas where they had interactive lighting going outside the windows of spaceships to, you know, like whatever it is that they're doing like that. And I've been on those stages. It gets you a lot of the way there. It doesn't get you though quite all the way there, because the one thing that you don't get is bright sunlight, because you're just getting an area light off the. So if you remember when we were talking about Hijacked, Ed Moore set up a bank of lights that could raise and lower outside the window, so he could have a bank of light shooting light through the windows of the craft, and as the plane banked, he would cause the lights to go up or cause the lights to go down. Exactly. And it would sort of arc around or pan around, rake around. Exactly. Yeah. And so I would say like that even, I guess what I'm saying is it would be wrong to think that just because you used an LED stage, you've kind of got that solved. Like, yes, you get you a long way there, but there's still a lot of craft from every department to pull that off, especially when you're doing in this show, which is daylight, high altitude bombing, which would be incredibly glary and incredibly bright in the lights coming in. The focus thing is the other thing we mentioned, but the third thing I wanted to mention is, I can really pick this up myself, is it's wrong spatially. So it's like they're going one way and it seems like the world is kind of going in a slightly different angle or different direction. And you see those shots, especially in older films, where clearly somebody just shot reel plate and they pop it in, and the movement in the reel plate just doesn't match the movement of what. Now, the classic on that is the driver, like the going old, down the road.
Yeah, the rear projection in like Vertigo or something, where it's so cool looking because it's like, wow, that's so neat. But yeah, it's kind of goofy, like, or it's somehow offset slightly, where it's like, wait, well, how's the road that high or something behind them or whatever
and
it
then,
might be.
And then they're not turning the wheel enough to go around the corner. and so I think that's the third thing that you can really go. And of course, that doesn't get solved by the LED stage, because if you haven't got the right motion base geometry, camera move, and obviously artificial stuff going up on the screens, then it's just going to be wrong. It's just like, oh, that's sliding sideways kind of thing. And again, I don't know you can necessarily in the moment articulate it. It just doesn't feel authentic and real. And I think, I don't know, I just, it's not the most complicated thing in the world to solve compared to some of the other challenges in the pantheon of VFX. But there's so much of it in this film. And had they got it wrong, it would have just taken you out of the film so badly. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's almost like my litmus test on good quality stuff.
There's a great, I just listened to this just over the at the tail end of last week. And there's a great episode, I think it's two episodes old now, of the Roger Deakins podcast, Team Deakins, with Roger and James Deakins talking to different people. And they had visual effects supervisor Pablo Hellman on there, also from ILM. And it's a fantastic interview. And just what you just said, James Deakins, you know, was asking questions, really detailed questions of Pablo. And he's great. He's so kind of easygoing and really so chill about everything. And she asked the question, you know, about that very thing about like the, when you've got the focus wrong, and that there's so many, you know, effects scenes in movies where there's something outside the window and they just don't match and follow the focus. Either they keep it too sharp or they throw it too soft. And it, that idea that there's, or can be, we don't see that in this at all, this Masters of the Air, but I think that there wasn't always that attention to detail on every kind of effects film at every kind of effects facility to really think about, all right, what was this shot on? What's that lens capable of? And when it's capturing the interior of vehicle X in this way, what's happening outside the window and what can we see? And I think that, you know, not having that and just sort of thinking about that kind of A over B and putting something together quickly and, you know, time is money, those kind of things, you start to really see them. And she made some comment about that, you know, just not understanding what happens with a lens and the way things would peer outside if you're focused on the subject matter inside, depending upon the millimeter depth of the lens and what the aperture is set at and all that kind of stuff. It was cool. It was good commentary.
Well, I think the other thing that, and this relates to these two crafts coming together and marrying, is, so here's my problem as a director. I want to see the actors' faces. And as a documentarian, you might say, well, this is all I got. But as a filmmaker, you say, well, I need light on their faces. Now, my number one hatred is in movies where they're either diving or in some kind of hazmat suit or any kind of full body suit, and they stick lights in the frigging helmet facing the person, which would just stop you from seeing anything. You just trip over your own feet.
You just see looking at your own reflection on the bubble in front of you.
And so at some point, the director is saying, but I need to see their faces because I spent a lot of money on these actors. And at another, and the audience wants to see it. Now, I think most audiences, unlike me, just buy that it makes sense to have lights in your helmet. But let's go back to the planes now. If you're in really high-con conditions, it's quite possible that you would have, as in space, incredibly stark highlights and very, very dark shadows because there just isn't a lot of bounce light. Now, you could argue, oh, there's always skylight and stuff, but that's so overpowered by just strong sunlight. And we know that because if you go and try and film a mate outside on your iPhone in full sun, they've got really ghastly black shadows across their faces.
And there's so much less diffusion in the air at that altitude, right? I mean, unless you're in a really dense cloud environment, so there would be less diffusion. You would get harder light.
So you've got to walk the line between, or it's not even walking the line, I think it's the craft of the filmmakers, both visual effects and DOP, to be able to give you believable lighting, not realistic lighting. And that's something that they've done well in this. It's believable when they're in the cockpit. Though if I was to draw up a single frame and start getting all mathematical about it, I might argue, well, where's the light coming out that's giving them light under their chins? Where's that coming from? Right? I can't imagine the instruments are lit up like that. And they've got overhead skylights effectively. So wouldn't they be in deep shadow? But the audience has to see what's going on because it's a film. It's not a documentary. It's not a technical reconstruction. So that's a lovely challenge, I think, for where the DOP and the visual effects team have to come together and solve the problem that facilitates the audience hearing. And by the way, I was about to say, same problem with hearing, because you'd never hear any dialogue between two people. You know, quite often in helicopters, you'll get people jumping in a helicopter and they're talking to each other. Right. Like, you know, it's not possible. Where are we going? And it's like, yeah, if you've ever been in a helicopter, you're like, what?
Yeah, totally.
Now, you've been up in one of these World War II planes, so I have not. I imagine they're pretty bloody noisy inside.
It's really loud, and especially when the one that I was in, they had the side door is wide open. Right. It's not like being in a commercial plane that we're so used to doing now. You're not in a pressurized cabin where it's, you know, pretty quiet, reasonably speaking, depending upon where you're sitting and maybe the age of the airplane. It's really loud and it stinks like burning oil and gasoline, and like it's dirty, you know, and there's real insulation either.
In a passenger plane, they play the audio out of phase back, right? So if I'm sitting next to you, right next to you, that's not being picked up by the mic. So I tend to be able to hear you and you can hear me. But the general hum is meant to be cancelled out by inverting the waveforms.
Yeah, yeah.
That's how they kind of make it quieter in a passenger plane. None of that tech exists in your experience of going up in World War II.
I mean, I'm just glad we landed safely and we weren't killed. It was so scary.
But by the way, I'm really glad that you landed safely and weren't killed as well.
Oh, thanks.
So these are the challenges that the crafts teams have. It's like, you know, you want plausible audio. It needs to be like that they're in a noisy environment, but not so that I can't hear them.
I was just thinking too, like as you describe all this, like I can't remember. I don't know if you've got that statistic in front of you, but the number of shots, I mean, because it's an episodic and each episode is roughly an hour in length, while there is a lot of action that's taking place on the ground, I think quite smartly, they do have a sort of Stalag 17 kind of vibe going on in part of the narrative where several of the pilots who are downed are captured and held by in a prison camp in Germany, and they're used as, because of the Geneva Conventions, right? They're treated fairly well, you know, all things considered, for being a prisoner of war. But I think they spare some expense in some ways there, although there are some great environmental visual effects in some of those settings as well. But there is a huge number of visual effect shots over the total. I can't remember what the episode arc is, if it's 8 or 10 episodes.
Nine episodes,
right in between. But I mean, there's thousands of visual effect shots, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, the number 5,000 springs to mind. I know I did get that number off Stephen. But by the way, now you've brought up the prisoner of war camp, let's just go there. Because for me, that was the most marvelous Easter egg. Because what bloke of our vintage hasn't seen The Great Escape at least 10 times?
Yeah, right.
I mean, it's like they didn't have to say, hey, this is The Great Escape and Steve McQueen, and like no one was trying to jump the fence. But just so you know.
Well, and in the United States, I don't know if you saw this growing up in Australia, but in the United States, the other one that's huge was Hogan's Heroes.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
totally.
It's kind of that same vibe.
Except for the whole idea of, Harry, Tom, Dick, and Harry, the three tunnels, and how many people they got out. And I mean, I just swear to God, if you're a bloke of our vintage, just sitting down to watch The Great Escape on a Saturday afternoon with a beer is just about as good
fantastic.
As it gets.
Yeah, for sure.
So having that kind of happening in the background, I thought was just delightful. It's interesting you were saying that they were well treated. I mean, while the Luftwaffe was running the camps, they were fairly well treated. Obviously, once
when the SS took over.
Yeah, bastards. But
yeah, I think that's the other thing that's really cool in this show is, I mean, all the air battle stuff is spectacular. There aren't really any shots that I've seen that really stood out to me as being problematic. I know in your interview with Steven Rosenbaum, you know, he said, well, you know, he hesitated. He, I think we all have shows we've worked on where there are CBBs, where we run out of time, or could be betters, right? That we sort of, that get finaled and they get put in the show. Now he seemed to indicate that there were things that he thought were a few things here and there that he still wasn't happy
Stephen's
with. Yeah,
I think Stephen's eye is better than my eye. I think Stephen just has a higher standard than I have. I think, swear to God, like,
yeah,
I've
been watching this on our television here, like, and it just looks so consistent. When you talk about a shot count, whether it's 3,500 or up closer to 5,000, as you were suggesting, I can't remember what the number was, but when you think about that number of shots across so many different kind of scenarios too, where you have different conditions, different times of day, different sort of, you know, attack scenarios, formations, where there's more planes, fewer planes, all the sort of bomb site footage. Then you've got all these environmental extensions when they land in North Africa. There's some environmental stuff there when they're at the, prison camp, or, the World War II London, when there's some R&R and some intelligence kind of action going on. And then also in parts of the German cities that they go through, there's so much interesting work and it's consistently really strong. I think having a shot count that high with such a complex narrative where there's many characters that we're following in all kinds of different scenarios, to keep that quality up and to really create a situation with all the visuals, and especially all the visual effects, where the audience isn't taken out of it, I think is a huge challenge. And I really feel like all the work that's done in this, it really is, sets a really high bar for an episodic production.
So let's get into that. Let's give some sun rather than shade to the teams that worked on it. So Stephen, we've already outlined, is just a great leader of a team, but he did a lot of work with a bunch of different companies. He told me, so I'm just secondhand, but you know, he told me directly, he was really impressed in particular with Whiskey Tree. Well, people that worked on it, Whiskey Tree, Rodeo, Weta, and Dineg did some of the stuff in the, started, I think, with Eps 1 and 2. But yeah, so Jonathan Harp did a lot of the environment work, Paris, Algeria that you're referring to in Africa, Holland and Nuremberg. And they couldn't do location work because of COVID, right? So Jonathan stepped up and just did a lot of really amazing plane work. And I believe, I'm pretty sure it was Whiskey Tree that did the D-Day sequence in Ep 8 that I just found spectacularly good. And I got to say, Jonathan, put that on your reel and nothing else, and mic drop, walk away. Thanks for playing.
Yeah, totally.
Rodeo, Patrick David. So they were doing the Starlight Camp stuff you were referring to. Like, they also did Digi Doubles, and they did a bunch of the P-40, what we call the Red Tails. Do you remember Spielberg made a Red Tails film? I think it was Spielberg.
Yeah, I think it was George Lucas, actually. I don't know.
Oh, George Lucas, right. Yeah.
George made it. And it was a story. Right. I know that Lucas had wanted to make from even way back when I was at ILM. It was something that was kicked around and as an idea. But yeah, he made that film, and there's some great visual effects in that. I'm sure there's some of that DNA that's crossed over into this series. I think it's a great inclusion in this too. Once that the P-51 sort of at the tail end of the European engagement is when I think the P-51 starts to come online as one of the available fighters in the
Yeah, but wasn't it the P-40 that they had for the Rome attack?
I think it was the P-47, maybe, I think. I can't remember what the actual number was, but I think it was something like
and
that.
Wayne and Wayne Staples at Weta did, well, we can't talk about Ep-9. I don't think Ep-9's gone to air yet as we're recording this.
Yeah, but, I think it comes out Weta, this week.
Yeah, because I mean, you know, like any, and I'm not saying that's absolutely all of them. They're just the ones that I made a note of.
But yeah, it's impressive. And it's impressive to see, like, you know, these big houses, but also some of these smaller companies that don't quite have the same, you know, personnel profile, maybe in terms of the numbers. I mean, but there's just so much amazing talent at all these places and really delivering the goods. He did, Stephen did mention too in your interview, which I thought was interesting, you know, talking about sharing assets and stuff. And he sort of seemed to suggest that, well, that certainly was something that was open to the realm of possibilities, that there still was always that thing where you, when you do have different houses working on the same project, where they all kind of do have a little bit their own kind of different flavor of pipeline, that they still wind up building a lot of things or reworking a lot of the stuff to sort of work within the confines of their proprietary tool sets. And that's kind of interesting too, when you think about a show of this size and all those variables being thrown into the mix, but still being able to really maintain a high bar of quality, I think says so much about, you know, all the teams working on it.
100%. And you know what? They just, it's reputation as well. Like you just hear, like Whiskey Tree, Rodeo, obviously Weta, but these companies like Whiskey Tree, which aren't like the big mega houses, you just hear their names coming up with tackling a relatively small number of shots and doing a really darn good job. And I think there's a real lesson there, because I think there's a temptation, and I'm pretty sure you'd agree with this, there's a temptation just to assume that growth is good in for itself, like you should just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And actually, there's nothing wrong in life with just being, hey, this is the size we're at, we do really good work, and we don't want to become...
I love it.
1,200 seat facility.
I talk about this all the time at my job. So I'm the chair of a big department at a state university, an art department that does a lot of traditional illustration and design work, but also does a lot of, you know, digital 3D and, you know, game engine work in the program. It's kind of an entertainment design discipline. And we're really focused right now as a school on growth. And I keep having this conversation over and over again that, like, well, yeah, I mean, like, we can keep getting bigger and bigger, but I don't know that we can necessarily maintain quality outcomes as we get larger. There's a whole nother, we'll make more money. We're increasing the amount of tuition dollars coming in. There's another model. And that other model is just what you're saying. It's like you focus on, you know, what can you actually do and maintain a really high bar of quality for all those moving through the machine, you know? And I think there's a lot to be said for that notion of not always just thinking about growth and size and really thinking about, you know, quality outcomes and maintaining a high bar and a high standard. But it's a different model.
It's so funny you should say that. But the anecdote I tell, because I 100% agree with you, my friend, is actually, I'm sure I got this from literally Wayne's World, but there's a joke in it where they're talking about quality music that you look back on and say, that's a brilliant album, and it's not top 40. It's not the most popular song. Mm-hmm. If you want to, like, you look at an artist like David Bowie, somebody that's had a huge career over time, obviously there are albums there that sold like hotcakes, right? But there's also really important work there that wasn't at the time number one in the charts.
Yeah.
But there are artists that are revered and that everybody likes and have very long, very respected careers. And they're just not topping the charts constantly. And there are other people that have massive hits and then just die away and that's it. Or you just go, well, that was a song that I remember, but I haven't heard it in ages because it was kind of a throwaway kind of whatever. And so the metric for judging success shouldn't be just a financial model of what's the gross that we get in here. The financial model is one of many metrics. And we actually, in my school, in my team here, because I have some PhDs working with me, one of my PhDs is actually looking at the issue of value. And the number of times when people say, is that valuable? They mean, is it financially valuable? And her actual thesis is kind of exploring. There are so many different valuables if you actually unpack it. It could be of great value to just your happiness. It could be of great value to the environment. Yeah. It could be of great value to sustainability or sustaining a long career. It could be value in terms of being able to sustain a long career, not burning out, right?
Absolutely.
There are so many concepts of what is valuable. And yet when somebody says, oh, that's really valuable to us, or that's of great value, nearly everybody just goes to the dollar value. And I got to say, like, time and time again, if I think of either music or even films that I just thought were absolutely brilliant, yeah, sure, sometimes they're blockbusters. I mean, I loved the original Jurassic Park, and it was a blockbuster. There's no question about it. But there are other films, I don't care how much money they made.
Totally.
If you think of the Usual Suspects, right? Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that was a box office failure, but it wasn't like a Jurassic Park. But anyone that I know that's seen that film thinks it's a beautiful work of art. And
I might even have some weirder examples. I mean, I loved, you know, Under the Skin. I loved Border, that movie about the weird, like, trolls in Sweden on the border. Like,
well, yeah.
I mean, there's so many great lower budget films.
Well, let's look at Poor Things in this run of Academy Awards, right?
Yeah.
Poor Things. I don't think anyone of us didn't think that was not a great film. It clearly didn't clean up at the box office in the way that now Oppenheimer did clear up at the box office, and it was also, in my opinion, a great film. But Poor Things will not go down in history as the biggest money making film of the year, and it didn't win all the Oscars. But I bet you that film's got legs and will have influence and be
especially after winning all these Oscars that it did win. I think it puts it on the radar of people who are like, oh yeah, I did hear about that. Well, we should check that out. You know, like, people are now, that's the whole point of the Oscars, really, is to hopefully shine a light on some of these smaller films and smaller moments where, you know, I frankly hope a lot of people get a chance to see the Jonathan Glazer movie, The Zone of Interest, and the Anatomy of a Fall, the Trier film. Those are all so great and really Mind important you, films, you know.
All of the documentary nominees this year were, how can I put this, not fun, happy films. They were films of substance, but they were not exactly date night films that you would take out.
Well, it's like I said, a Zone of Interest after watching it. My son was like, he's home on spring break from Boston, and he's like, so what? Yeah, how was it? What'd you think? And I was like, oh, it's the feel good movie of this season. Like, it's so dark and it's so hard, but it also feels so important. And there's some amazing thermal camera work in it that's so fascinating. And the sound design, it justly won that award. I mean, it is the most spectacular sound design I've heard in a movie in a long time. It's totally original.
So just bringing this back to VFX for a second. So my reason mentioning Poor Things, right, is that Union is not a huge house that did the effects for that.
Yeah.
And they're a small house. They did really, really good work. We talked about Whiskey Tree and others. I think that the trick with those smaller houses is what you really want to do is build up a good reputation in an area and realize that you don't have to be a good reputation in every area. In other words, you don't have to be really good at digital humans and water sims and, you know, like, environments and everything, right? Like, I feel like if you can get a really good reputation for doing stuff and not try and be 3,000 people.
Tippett was kind of that for a long time. I think they now have even a broader reputation than they did. But when I was there on Matrix 3 and Hellboy, and their real reputation, although they were really starting to do more work at that time under supervisor Craig Hayes, they were doing some pretty interesting work on Matrix 3 in particular. But they were also kind of always thought of as like a creature facility. Like, that was their jam, was creatures, you know? And I think they still have that because that's really kind of Phil Tippett's, you know, historical legacy background. It really makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's his jam. But I think, it's really kind of cool when a smaller facility really can glom on. There was I think they have since been sold, but when they first came online, was it Scanline too? And their Scanline big thing was fluid and thermal dynamics and stuff.
Oh, yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, completely. And that was just the go-to place. If you wanted to get a aircraft carrier to come out of the water and go up in the sky and you wanted water pouring off it, Scanline would give you the water that looked realistic. And I just feel like it's such a temptation to grow. And the other problem with growing is you have dips between projects. You can't avoid it. If you have 1,000 staff and you have a dip between projects, it can bankrupt you. If you've got a team of 30 and you've got a dip between projects, well, you know, hopefully
you might be able to cruise a little longer. Yeah.
Yeah. pick up small bits and pieces.
I think there's opportunities too in maybe in some of those smaller facilities for something that I think is becoming so much more valuable. At least, you know, in the small time I ran my business, we never had more than 18 employees, I think, at our peak. But, you know, what I always looked for was I wanted people who, you know, weren't a one-trick pony. You know, there's that idea like, oh, well, I'm just an animator. I'm like, really? Like, you don't do any lighting, or you can't do any like camera match moves, or you can't do any roto, or like, I could really use you to come on board. And like, I'd love to keep you for the whole show. Like, and if you can start to engage in a meaningful way in multiple disciplines, maybe you're not as good at, you know, this thing as you are at the thing you really love, but maybe you can become more of a human Swiss Army knife, and you can be much more useful to the production in total over the course of time and be a real utility player, as opposed to being, just somebody that I can only use for, you know, a few weeks, and then I got to cut you loose because I don't have anything else for you to do.
Which naturally brings us to Godzilla Minus One's team, the small team where everybody gets involved, everybody's doing stuff.
Yeah.
And they
what a spectacular night for them too. Last night, we're recording this the Monday after the Oscars, but yeah.
So congrats to that team. But we kind of drifted away a bit from Master of the Air, but it's worth just noting how much those guys did a fabulous job and how much everybody, it was funny. A friend of mine summed it up. I don't want to quote him directly because he didn't, it was a private comment that he made, but it was basically like, you know, let me see if I can remember what he said. It was basically, how does like Godzilla stack up? And he said, what's on the screen gets you on the short list, and what happened behind the screen gets you on the stage to win the prize. And that's somebody who's shiny silver, golden statues themselves.
It's well said. I mean, yeah, I think that narrative, I mean, I didn't see it. I wasn't there, but my understanding is that the Bake Off, when that presentation really captured the hearts and minds of the voting block there in the VFX branch. And I just think, you know, it's true. Like, that's another thing, you know, bringing it back to sort of these interviews and these conversations with people too, you know, not to be too hokey, but I feel like as I get older, you know, the thing that I realize, and Pablo said this in his interview on the Team Deacons podcast, Pablo Hellman, you know, said that when you get down to it, at the end of the day, like, it's people. It's always comes back to this thing. It's about the people that you work with and having that team, that camaraderie, that trust, that understanding of one another. And, you know, I think what your friends quote, you know, I think it speaks volumes to like this ephemeral thing that when, you know, maybe smaller teams have, you can have this on big teams too, but I think small teams maybe are more amenable to that kind of, you know, I always used to talk about sort of the gallows humor that springs up when you're working on a big show with a bunch of people, and that camaraderie and that kind of sense of shared experience, shared struggle, shared sacrifice. And in this case, at least with the Godzilla team, that shared joy and victory, you know, I think that's a really interesting part of, it's not just about the technical skills, but there is that other thing behind the scenes that can make or break a team.
Yeah, and just to bring it back to our show this week, I will actually say the other thing that I'm sure you'd agree with is there really is a sense of leading from the top, right? If you don't have someone like Stephen who's really setting the tone, if you've got an abusive tone, a non-inclusive tone where ideas are, you know, need to be put through channels because it's not your place to speak up, if you get that kind of wrong culture going, people just don't lean into the project, and that's the end of it. I know we're out of time. I know you've got to go. So let's just finish up by saying, if you haven't seen all of Masters of the Air, please do. It's friggin' awesome.
Totally
it's great
worth
visual
your time.
Effects work. Absolutely. Hopefully Jason Diamond will be joining us for our June 2 ep coming up very soon. We're all looking forward to that. Yes, very, very good. Though I really want to talk to you about June 3, but anyway. But Matt, where can people find you if they want to connect?
Let's see. I'm on Mastodon, and my favorite thing I'm doing now, which I think is so appropriate for the show, is if anybody who's not on it, get on Letterboxd. It's a social network that's just about movies and about, you know, rating and writing brief reviews for movies and logging what you've seen. And it's great fun, and it feels really connected to just to this kind of dialogue in particular, because obviously everybody listening to this is a movie lover, you know, so it's something I think is really so much more fun than so many of the other things that can sometimes be kind of a downer.
And just to say again, if you want to hear the podcast with Stephen, that was number 365 over on FX Guide. And if you go to the FX Guide homepage, there's a link to the Reunion RC podcast that we mentioned at the beginning, discussing
yes.
with Jason coming back. And thanks so much for being with us. And until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright FX Guide, LLC.